Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all-purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Immigrants have not changed. They have the same need, the same humanity. What has changed are the laws. There are no lines to get into, so that creates unlawful immigration, and unlawful immigration leads to vulnerability and invisibility for immigrants. And so that's really the issue. I found out in my research that 98% of the people who came through Ellis Island were admitted to the U.S. Basically, if you had lice or, you know, a disease that was evident, you weren't allowed to enter, but 98%. So basically, if you could get your body on the ship, you were in. And so that has changed dramatically, even though right now we are experiencing the greatest refugee crisis that we know of in recorded history. Mm-hmm. It's greater even than after World War II. I mean, it's terrible. And only 4% of refugees are ever resettled.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast. I am your lonely host, John Williamson. I'm here sitting in the studio all by my lonesome because Adam, my dear friend, is out there somewhere traveling and helping people with rare diseases. So he's doing good work. So he's out there for a good reason. But I bring you today a new episode. Unfortunately, Adam could be a part of it, but we have the next best thing. Our dear friend Katie Herdert, whose name might sound familiar to you if you've been listening to the podcast for a while, she pinch hit for Adam at the end of 2018, at the end of last year. I believe it was December, but she helped fill in and co-host on our episode on purity culture, lending a very needed and important female perspective on that whole movement. So she's amazing and was gracious enough to sit in with me again on this episode. Another important topic to me personally, I think it's been weighing on me quite a bit over the last several years as we've had some major issues with our immigration policies and with families at the border and that sort of thing. So is an interesting topic that I found myself very ignorant on. And so it was very eye-opening to come across this book that I found profound and educational and inspiring because there are some aspects, some stories that I grew up with that she really tells from a different perspective and especially from the perspective of someone who herself immigrated to the United States from Guatemala as a child. You know, there was a lot for me to learn. There's a lot I would assume for a lot of folks out there listening to take away from this. So anyway, it's a great book. Again, it's called The God Who Sees Immigrants, the Bible, and the Journey to Belong, published through Herald Press, came out in May of this year. It's fantastic. We'll have all of her links to her social media In the show notes, so you can find her on Twitter, Instagram, and all that good stuff. She also has a couple blogs that you can check out where she writes more frequently, but she's a sought-after speaker. She writes on a whole host of different topics. Like I said, she's a fantastic theologian. She's contributed to publications like Sojourners, Christianity Today, The Christian Century, and a ton of other publications. And she's got a cat named Scully that I regret not asking about. I'm hoping that just means she's a giant X-Files fan like I am. So who knows? Maybe next time we have her on, I'll ask her. But again, I hope you guys take away from this conversation as much as we took away just being a part of it. Like I said, it's just something that, you know, is happening in real time right now. There's a very real crisis at our borders. You know, no matter which side you come from, I think the Bible is very pretty clear on how we should be treating our immigrant brothers and sisters. So great episode. Hope you guys enjoyed it as much as we did. Music on this episode, Jordy Searcy. You know, he's a wonderful musician, young dude. I can say that now. I'm 40. So but young guy, talented musician, writes some really profound stuff. And if his name sounds familiar, if you happen to watch The Voice, he was featured on The Voice and was gracious enough to let us use some of his music for this episode. So in particular, the one at the very beginning, and we'll play the full track at the end, is just really hits the nail on the head. So go out and support him, follow him on social media, tell him we sent you, and you know, support him, buy his music. You can find it everywhere good music's found, of course, iTunes, Spotify, Apple Music, all the usual suspects. So again, hope you guys love this episode as much as we love doing it. Thank you guys so much for being patient with us and hanging in there. I know we haven't had a ton of content out this year. We're working on it. Life is getting slowing down a little bit, but we are putting in the time to get some episodes done and in the can. And like I said, we've got a two-parter coming in November that will kind of explain some of the chaos of the beginning part of our year, but really important episodes for us. And then we've got a couple of really cool ones on the topic of grief heading into the holidays. So we're going to end the year strong, and then we'll kick off 2020 and try to get back in the flow of things. But until then, here is our guest this week. Without further ado, Karen freaking Gonzalez. Be right.
If you really want to pray to him, but you're never sure he's listening, 'cause who could forgive what you did last night? I'm so sorry for what you've heard. We're broken poets.
Well, welcome to the Deconstructionist podcast. It's weird for me to say because that's usually not my part, but Adam is not here today, unfortunately. But we have our very capable, what would we call you? Like a pitch hitter?
Sure.
Pinch hitter, right?
Yeah.
Co-host Katie, who you may remember from the end of last year. So, so Katie is here with us. And also, more importantly, we have a very special guest with us today. Welcome to the Deconstructionist podcast, Karen Gonzalez.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for being here. Like I said, you know, before we started recording, we are really excited to have you on to talk about a topic that is really important to us, specifically, you know, in terms of the political times and the climate that we find ourselves in currently. And so tell the listeners, for those who aren't familiar with maybe your background and what you do, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I am an immigrant myself from Guatemala. So I write about immigration from a very personal perspective because it is, in fact, my story. I migrated to the U.S. from Guatemala when I was 9 years old. And I would say that my story of immigration is very closely tied to my story of faith. I was born into the Catholic Church and just explored faith throughout my life and became a serious follower of Jesus through InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which is a parachurch ministry on college campuses. And after that, I went overseas and served as a, you know, as a Christian service worker, missionary. And then I eventually went to seminary also. And then I currently work for an organization that serves immigrants and refugees. All our work in the U.S. is with the foreign-born. We do refugee resettlement and immigrant legal services, and we work with survivors of trafficking who are also, you know, foreign-born, which is the majority of them anyway in the United States. And that organization is called World Relief. And this week, we had some really sad news because we had to close one of our offices because refugee resettlement is down to a trickle under the current presidential administration. Yeah. But that is a bit about my story, and I guess work is so closely connected to that that it's hard for that not to come out too.
Well, one of the main reasons we wanted to have you on is because you have this great book out. It's called The God Who Sees: Immigrants, the Bible, and the Journey to Belong. Tell us a little bit about that. And obviously, one of the things that on the Deconstructionist podcast that we notice is that, at least to us anyway, this immigration situation seems like a pretty obvious thing when you really read the Bible, specifically the New Testament. But the entire Bible really has a lot to say about immigration, how we should treat immigrants. And so tell us the inspiration behind what led you to write this book.
So when I started working at World Relief, I started as a church mobilizer, which means I would go to churches in the Baltimore, D.C. area where I live, and I would talk to them about God's heart for immigrants. And the majority of them were evangelical churches, but I also worked with a lot of mainlines because it is, you know, the kind of the Northeast, so there's a lot of mainline churches. And when I was doing that, I read a lot of books on the subject, of course, because I would preach and teach and talk about the Bible and what the Bible says. And I started to notice that most of the texts written about immigration from a biblical perspective were all written by white people. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. This is not an indictment of that at all. I think there's a place for that for sure. But there's also a place for us as immigrants to be telling our own stories. And that's what I wasn't seeing. And, you know, I went to see Hamilton, and that was my ultimate inspiration because I was like, this is so
that's
interesting.
Awesome.
Yeah, because you have this story, right, of an immigrant founding father, right, from a different social class, different family, different country. And the story of the founding of America from his perspective is so different from the one that I was taught.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this is a perspective that's needed. And so I began praying and thinking about writing the book, but that's where it came from.
That's so awesome. That's really exciting. So what was the reception at these churches that you brought your message of reaching out and touching immigrant lives through World Relief? What was the welcome that you got there?
So I will tell you that I found not a big difference between mainline churches and evangelical churches. I think that what I did find, however, is that mainline church pastors, and these would be your Presbyterians, Lutherans, Methodists, were much more welcoming. The pastors themselves were easier to access and talk to than evangelical pastors. But in terms of the congregations, I didn't find that much difference at all. In fact, there's a lot of misinformation out there. There are a lot of people whose view of immigration is more informed by their peers, by the media, by their family, than it is by the words of Jesus, frankly. And so in terms of that, I didn't find that much difference. The access was just different because, you know, there's this whole thing in the evangelical church, you know, the Billy Graham rule about not meeting alone with women. And so it makes it harder for women to have access, right, to pastors. But in fact, the questions that I received, because I would always do a sermon or a presentation depending on the church, and then the questions that I received were similar, very similar questions, very similar attitudes, very similar biases, you know, against immigrants and immigration in general. So it was very interesting from that perspective, and it's been true with the colleagues that I had at the time as well. That's what they found. In fact, the work that World Relief does, we do with in partnership with mostly evangelical church volunteers. And so they help with the resettlement of refugees. They help with English classes, job services, all of the things that refugees need to learn as they come into this new country, we do with the help of volunteers. And so don't get me wrong. I think there is a political sort of evangelical church out there, you know, what you hear under people like Jerry Falwell and Franklin Graham, that definitely exists. But I didn't find that they were any less welcoming than non-evangelical churches.
That's great. One of the things I want to definitely touch on, and you really dive into this in the book, and there are some really kind of stunning statistics in here. I thought, like, just really eye-opening for me, and you know, I acknowledged before I even began reading the book that there's inevitably a lot I don't even know about, you know, how immigration works within the United States. And I knew it was difficult based on some friends who had come over from Australia and had kind of recounted their experience with it and just how difficult and expensive and time-consuming it was from their end. So, you know, they were always quick to say, hey, you have no idea how much more difficult it must be if you come into the country with, like, very little money. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, because I think this is something that people don't often think about, especially when, you know, we get into these debates from the comfort of our homes here, where we don't have to worry about gang violence and drug wars and that sort of thing. But one of the things you point out is something like 60% of immigrant women crossing the border in the United States are sexually assaulted. And additionally, some organizations have said that as high as 80% of trafficking victims are foreign-born women and girls.
Yeah, that's correct. And it's a statistic I've seen in many different places. And that one in particular came from Amnesty International. But it's very common. And when I worked in the immigration legal clinic at World Relief, there wasn't a day that went by that I didn't meet a woman who had not been a victim of sexual assault. It was, it's terrible. The things that are happening to women in particular, they just face a vulnerability that men don't. And the real crisis at the border is the vulnerability of immigrant women. They experience so much danger entering the U.S. And then once they're here, there's very poor conditions in the U.S. And so it's really, really terrible. It's in fact so bad that even Catholic groups, you know, who are famously not in favor of birth control, will distribute birth control so that women don't become pregnant as a result of the rapes.
Oh, my
gosh. That is so telling.
Yeah, it's really shocking.
So one of the things I think that would be a good thing to clarify, I guess, is you kind of touch on this in the book too, and I'd love for you to talk about this, is the reasons behind which these families, in most cases, are risking life and limb to come over to the United States. Because, you know, a lot of cases, I read an article not too long ago, actually, about families who were lucky enough to have the means to do so, that were trying to cross over in the United States from Mexico in these border cities that had become absolute war zones between rival drug gangs, which ironically were basically came about as a result of the drug addiction in the United States and the demand for drugs. So in a sense, like, we caused this problem, and then, you know, you have these families who, again, you know, if they have the means to leave and pack up and leave, are risking their lives just to keep their families safe, to keep their children safe. And these, again, are things that we don't, I mean, Adam and I talked about this in our prior podcast, where we talked about, well, how did I win the human lottery? You know, I was born a heterosexual white male in the 20th century in the United States of America to a middle-class family who are educated, and I got to go to university, but completely random chance. You know, I didn't choose for that to happen. And so I can't, you know, I can't imagine what it must be like to have a family in a place where there's a war going on, like you talk about in the book, in Guatemala, or, you know, these drug wars happening in Mexico, and having to make that decision to try to take my entire family, uproot them from the culture that I grew up with and that I know and love, and, you know, and go into a completely foreign land. So what are some of the reasons that you've seen working with this organization? Why are they risking life and limb to come over?
You know, there's a Somali poet, Warsan Shire, who has this great quote from one of her poems. She says, "No one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark."
Ugh.
Wow.
And I think it's really powerful because if you think about it, many of the immigrants I talked about in my book, none of them dreamed of leaving home. And most immigrants today, including me, most immigrants are not sitting around in their countries thinking about the American dream. Because when you leave, it's extremely traumatic. You leave pieces of yourself behind, your home, your comfort, your heart language, your extended family, your very sense of self is taken from you. And you have to start all over again, almost like a child in a new country. And it's a deeply painful and, like I said, very traumatic experience. And immigrants embark on that journey either for economic reasons, if you want to feed your family, or have a need to protect their lives and those of the people that they love. So the primary reasons that people migrate to the U.S. are to work, to reunite their families, meaning dad left a long time ago and is working in the U.S. and mom and the kids are in another country, right? And then also to flee persecution and violence. So what we're seeing right now, the humanitarian crisis at the border, is asylum seekers. And I want to define that because I'm not sure if people know what an asylum, what asylum is or what asylum seeker is. But these are people who flee their home country due to war or violence. And they present themselves at a port of entry to the U.S., and they apply for asylum, and the application is based on persecution for their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So, for example, if you are, if you were a transgender person and you were fleeing your country, that would put you in a membership of a social group. That's a social group because LGBTQ people suffer greatly around the world. They're some of the most vulnerable immigrants. So asylum seekers, which is a part of our law to apply for asylum, you just apply when you come to the border and you're usually paroled into the country, which means you can go and be with your relatives because the applications, if you are found to have a credible fear and you apply, the applications take about 2 years to adjudicate. So it's a long time. And less than 10% of asylum applications are successful. Less than 10%.
That's staggering.
So this is why it's so terrible, because it's part of, we're denying people something that is a part of our own law that they can apply for asylum. You know, the president essentially wants to block people from something that is American law. And then even in that, the people who have applied before he took office, only 10% are successful. It's so difficult to prove persecution because we're talking about people who are poor. We're talking about people who have, you know, just fled. A lot of them fled because they were, their lives were in danger. And so they just, they didn't take time to sit around and organize. You know, I've seen asylum applications be successful, but it's typically like a journalist from another country who has all this proof, right? Of hate mail and things that they wrote. And so it's just, it's a very heartbreaking situation at the border because of what's happening and the way our own laws are being violated by our leaders.
So one of the things I'd love for you to add on to that is there's another law that I was not familiar with at all, I'll be honest. And I'm trying to find it in my notes here, but it was like a 3x10 law or something like that. Does that?
The 3 and 10 year bar.
Yeah.
So this is a statute that came, came under Bill Clinton. He's the one that actually put this statute as part of immigration law. And basically it says that if you have been in the United States unlawfully, so you were not admitted and you have accumulated more than 6 months of unlawful presence, you are barred from the country for 3 years if you apply. So let's say, for example, that I crossed the border, you know, as an undocumented person, and I marry a U.S. citizen. So I would be able to adjust my status, right? Because now I'm married to a U.S. citizen. But if I had acquired 6 months of unlawful presence, I have to go back to my country for 3 years before I can apply. And so I either my spouse would come with me, right? Or he and I would just be separated for 3 years. Mm. The other one is 10 years. So if you acquire a year or more, you're barred for 10 years. So there's lots of people who could actually adjust their status who aren't able to because of this statute.
Outside looking in, all you hear is how we've come so far. Oh, Rosalind, how come we judge your skin? Never give a damn about your heart.
It's such a strange notion. It doesn't really follow any sort of logic on why that's necessary or what that accomplishes, other than potentially just the breakup of families and marriages. It just doesn't, I have a hard time figuring out what the real motivation behind that was, other than to harm people.
Yes, it's, and you know, I like to tell people that it was Bill Clinton who signed that into law, because there's a big perception out there that, oh, the Democrats are the good ones in right. immigration and the, but actually, Democrats have done a lot of harm. You know, Obama sure. welcomed 85,000 refugees, which is wonderful and a credit to him. But he also was the deporter in chief. He did a great deal of harm to undocumented immigrants in the U.S. And just like this statute that Bill Clinton put in place that supposedly was going to deter unlawful immigration, but nobody even knows about this statute until it comes time to adjust their status. Then they find out, what? This is a law? I didn't know this, you know? So it's a law that doesn't do its job because no one knows about it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It's very sad and very, yeah, it seems like so punitive for something, you know, that's so, that before was not a problem, you know?
Well, the practicality of it is, it's yes. just so wildly impractical for anyone to leave, you know, the job and relationships and family that they have founded here in whatever 6 month or beyond that time. It just really ruins their economic and relational fortunes.
Yeah. I met this man, actually. I went to the Calvin Festival of Faith and Writing a couple years ago. The last one they had, I think it was 2017. Cool. And on my way back home from the airport, the driver that I had was like an Uber driver, and he and I started having a conversation because he was Latino, I'm Latina, so we're having a conversation. And he told me that he actually was married to an American citizen and that he and his wife had to move to Mexico, where they lived, just over the border from Texas. And she would cross the border every day and work in Texas. And they had to do that for 10 years while he was barred from being in the U.S.
Oh, my gosh.
And then they even had kids, you know. And it was just, and I'm like, but how many people are able to do something like that?
You right, know,
that's
right.
so harsh. And yeah, our laws are very outdated and it needs true reform and update rather than just these little statues that keep being tacked on, you know, by different presidents who are in office.
Right. Well, because it kind of, the way that you're talking about it, it kind of makes it sound like the statutes don't necessarily serve the actual purpose. They're not useful for limiting folks who want to come here because, yeah, they just don't know about it. They're not going to be deterred by that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and additionally, you know, just kind of going down that train of thought, you know, how do we fix the current system? And obviously, we're entering into another election cycle here, unfortunately. So now we all get bombarded with leaflets and commercials and that sort of thing. But so now we have all of these candidates who are you know, promising the world as they do, you know, before they get in there. And and so we've seen a couple of debates now. We've got a multitude of Democratic candidates. Obviously, we've got a president in there who, through this strange idea again of deterrent, you know, by separating families from the children and everything, you see these horrific pictures down there. Obviously, that doesn't seem to be deterring anyone. And now you've got these Democratic candidates who are going to run against him. And obviously immigration is going to be one of the major topics of conversation. So what being someone who's worked on the front lines and you've seen the ugliness of it and you've seen kind of the what's the word I'm looking for? These laws that are archaic that just simply aren't working as intended. What would you like to hear out of a candidate? Like, what would be some useful, tangible, realistic reform that we could make that would help both sides?
Well, I would like to see comprehensive immigration reform that does three things. One, it makes it harder to immigrate or work illegally. So this means we have a secure border and we create an enforceable workplace authorization system. So right now, people can pick and choose if they want to do E-Verify as an employer. And that doesn't make any sense to me if we want to have an enforceable authorization system. So that's one, make it harder to immigrate or work illegally. Two, make it easier to enter and to work lawfully. We have labor needs in our country. We have an aging population, and immigrants come in their prime working ages. And the fact is 70 to 75% of the people of our food comes from California Central Valley, okay? Mm-hmm. And like 70% of those workers are undocumented immigrants. Our citizens simply are not going to do those jobs. We have even tried that and they haven't taken those jobs. So we have labor needs. Immigrants right now make up 13% of the population, but they make up 16% of the workforce.
Wow.
And so that's something that we need. And also, I mean, as Christians and as human beings, we should care about keeping families together. And so make it easier to enter and work lawfully. And then three, require those who are here unlawfully to earn legal status. They could pay a penalty, pass a background check, pay taxes. And I think any candidate that talks about a comprehensive reform to the system like that, I think is a really, is a candidate that I want to hear from. And so far, you know, they're not that far along yet to where they've talked about the ins and outs of these things. But that to me is real comprehensive immigration reform, because I think a lot of people have the perception that those of us who are immigration advocates and who care about immigrants, that we somehow want open borders.
Right.
And in an ideal world, yes. You know, but the fact is, we're not going to go back, you know, 500 years to when there were no borders as we understand them today. And so the reality is, we're going to have a border. So let's have a secure one, but not a militarized border. I think it's so cruel. We have this militarized border right now, and we don't have an invading army in Mexico. We have poor migrants fleeing violence and terror and famine, in fact.
Yeah. And the language is just so demonizing that is being used that to really try, I mean, what they say, caravanning, like that just is kind of silly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, it's cruel that what's happening right now, and it's not helping us. It's not helping them. This is something, you know, it's kind of like you're at this standstill and we could be caring for our neighbors. All these resources we're putting into more border patrol, we could be using to actually care for our neighbors in need. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, I would love to get into the book now and really talk about, because I think one of the important things too is not only talk about like what's going on at the border, but really tie it back to just so I can make my evangelical friends feel really bad. No, I'm just kidding. But sort of. But so I think you do a great job of the way that you have the book laid out. You kind of divide up the chapters and the references in scripture. And what I thought was really cool is, I mean, I definitely learned a lot. And so you start with the book of Ruth, which I thought was really neat. And you tell the story from kind of a different angle that I really enjoyed. And so talk a little bit about that, like Ruth and kind of the laws that are, or at least the protections and the respect and that sort of thing that she's allotted as she herself is an immigrant and also You referenced this New Testament term, and I'm probably going to butcher this, but philoxenia? Is that right? Okay.
Uh-huh.
So what does that mean? And talk about, like, what? How does Ruth really just kind of set the example of how the Bible really, you know, and how God wants us to treat immigrants?
Yeah, that's a great question. But philoxenia is the opposite of xenophobia, which is a fear and hatred of immigrants. Philoxenia is a love and embrace of immigrants.
And that's in the Bible?
And that's in the Bible. It's in the New Testament. Yes, because it's in Greek.
There we go.
And we don't see a translation like that, right? But that's the translation. And I love the book of Ruth, and I always have. And in fact, I talk in the book about the first time I ever encountered that text, and it was in relation to a wedding. There were those words from Ruth, wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you stay, I will stay. And your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And in fact, her words are not about marriage or love or loyalty they are about love in the sense that she loves her mother-in-law, but mm-hmm. it's not about romantic love like you would have at a wedding. And these are words spoken about her commitment to migrate with her mother-in-law. Mm-hmm. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. And they've just experienced all these losses, and they're returning to Naomi's hometown of Bethlehem because they're widows, they don't have any sons, grandsons, and they're in dire need. Mm-hmm. And so they return. And what happens when they return is so beautiful, because I'm so used to reading stories in the Bible where God tells the Israelites to do something and they disobey, and God sends prophets and judgment. And
yeah, but a lot of it.
Yeah.
But in this story, that does not happen. And it's shocking because in Deuteronomy 23, it says that Ammonites and Moabites, and Ruth was a Moabite, mm-hmm. can't belong to the Lord's assembly, not even the 10th generation of such people. In fact, they were forbidden from marrying Moabite women. And yet, when she returns, happens to be at the beginning of the harvest, she's welcomed unto the field of Boaz. Mm-hmm. And there she gleans what the harvesters had left behind, just as God had instructed. God had said to his people, when you are reaping the harvest of your field and you leave some grain in the field, don't go back and get it. Let it go to the immigrants, the orphans, and the widows. Similarly, with olives and olive trees and grapes from your vineyard, let the leftovers go to these people that are on the margins. And this is what happens for Ruth. She's allowed. And the work that she performs is not undignified or demeaning, the way that many immigrants in our context, they do the work that nobody else wants to do.
Right.
But the work that she does is hard work, but it's exactly the kind of work that everyone else in ancient Judah did. And she's not just entitled to a job, but to respect. You know, Boaz tells his workers, his male workers, hey, no name calling, no harassment, no assault. Mm-hmm. And both of them are entitled to Sabbath, time off for rest and reflection and celebration and worship. In fact, she is welcomed and loved to such a degree that she marries Boaz, mm-hmm. who is, you know, a man from Judah. And she becomes the grandmother of King David and is in the lineage of Jesus that's mentioned in Matthew. And all along, you know, we don't learn the story from that context, but she is a foreign woman who is welcomed into this society. And what I really love about this story is that there's such mutuality in it. You know, they bless her, they receive her, but she blesses them too. She brings her love and her loyalty. She brings her hard work. You know, she marries, integrates fully into this community, and she becomes one of them. It's really what you see in the journey of salvation, right? You start out as a stranger and you end up in the family of God. It's such a beautiful story.
Yeah. Well, I loved the layout of that contrast and compare the treatment of Ruth in the book of Ruth and to the plight of the American immigrant agricultural worker, especially a woman, you know, dealing with yes. those very long hours, the physical punishment of the labor itself, but also the risk of assault and abuse by coworkers or managers, and how much she was well taken care of, but we are really failing these people in this way. And I loved what you said. I'll quote you here, but compassion for those who are poor and marginalized is considered more important than efficiency or profit. And I think that's a huge piece of what's missing in, I mean, one of the bottom line, I felt like that could be a whole book in itself of how, you know, there was some loss of profit for Boaz to let Ruth glean in his fields, and but that was biblically mandated, and he actually obeyed it, like you said, to point out that that really kind of stark contrast to a lot of other spots in the Bible. It just is really important, I think, that especially America and our individualized culture and everything that has been kind of put on a pedestal about our society is really failing anyone who isn't, you know, reaching that achievement level, or you know, the people that are the poor in spirit, the immigrants, foreigners, anyone who's in that position. It's just really terribly sad.
Yeah. Yeah, that story stands in such sharp contrast to our system today, you know, and we think of people in the Old Testament as these primitive people, but
sometimes,
yeah. It's so interesting. And I really love that story and the way that we see that. And it's interesting because that story, people often think of Boaz as sort of the hero that comes in and saves the day, the kinsman redeemer. But really the story is about these two women, and Naomi is the person who changes the most in that story. She's the one that goes from despair to hope in God.
One of the things too, I think that that's important to note is the fact that you, you mentioned that they were both widows, and in that time period, what would that have meant for two women who had no sons, no husbands, that sort of thing?
You know, the true, though sexist, fact was that in the ancient world of the Bible, a woman without a husband was not a woman. No protection, no one to provide for you without sons, without husband. It really, your only assurance of economic security was to be married. It's not as if you could make your own way in the world. You had to be married or connected to a male in some way, as a son, or in Naomi's case, a male relative, right? That's why she's so excited about Boaz being a relative of hers. So yeah, truly people on the margins of society who were more often than not so destitute. You know, when I started reading about widows in the ancient world, it gave me new eyes when I would read stories in the New Testament about widows, because I just realized, wow, this reader wants me to know that this person is the most vulnerable of all vulnerable people, you know?
Yeah.
And it talks about widows and orphans all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to us, you know, these things, because, you know, my dad's a widower and I don't, you know, I know widows that are in our context, it doesn't have the same weight, right?
That word. No, not anymore. You're right. Mm-hmm.
Gosh. So one of the other examples that you give as you get into the book is you talk about Abraham and Sarah. Mm-hmm. And I thought this was really interesting because you really shed some light on the fact that, you know, everyone who's gone to Sunday school has probably at one point or another heard some of the stories. And there's some crazy stories in the Bible, and specifically Abraham pretending like his wife is his sister is definitely up there with weird stories in the Bible. But you kind of point out, kind of as we go along the timeline, Abraham obviously does this for a reason. There's obviously a reason behind it. For protection and that sort of thing. But talk a little bit about, like, just really, like, how serious that was. I mean, and you point out, rightly so, that, I mean, essentially what he's doing is he's trafficking his own wife.
Right. So Abraham and Sarah, Abraham experiences a famine. And that's really the number one reason in the Bible for migration. Mm. There's a famine in the land, And when that happens, people go off in search of food. And Egypt was this place where people frequently went when there was famine because of the Nile River and its very fertile riverbanks.
And that so they weren't the hidden. Story of Joseph too,
like right.
that you
yeah.
point out in a different part of the book of Joseph having migrated, or well, you know, he was trafficked there too, but he had a lot to do with famine and relief of famine.
Yeah, for sure. And that's what brings Abraham and Sarah to Egypt. And they probably arrived at some kind of gate. There was probably a road that was commonly taken by bands of immigrants like them. And they arrive. And when they arrive at this place and they're questioned, Abraham commits fraud. He lies. He says, she's my sister, which is a half-truth because she's also his wife. And he tells Sarah, I mean, he tells her, I mean, it's the very thing that you hear that traffickers do, help me, protect me. You know, mm-hmm. if you do this for me, you know, we'll be okay. And she is sent off to the palace to be with Pharaoh, and Abraham grows prosperous. You know, he has land and cattle and all of this stuff, and she's being trafficked with a Pharaoh. And it's a really terrible story. And when I read it, this is one of the reasons I love the Bible, because it's so descriptive. Here's a perfect place for the Bible to lie to us and right. give us this beautiful,
oh,
perfect
yeah.
picture of Abraham.
Yeah.
And instead, we get the truth. We get the truth about a very imperfect person who acts out of fear and anxiety and self-protection. And we might also say cowardly, right?
Very much so.
He lets her suffer while he grows wealthy. And yet we have this story. It always makes me think of Bryan Stevenson, the attorney, you know, civil rights attorney. He says, each of us is more than the worst thing that we've done.
Yeah.
Well, here we are. Here we are with Abraham, one of the worst things he has ever done. And God still tells us, right? He's the father of the faith, which is so fascinating. And we take all of this information about Abraham, right? None of us, I never heard a sermon saying that Abraham was a horrible person and none of us should look at his story or follow his example. People always take the elements of his story and put them in the context of his whole life, right? Mm-hmm. And of also God's journey with Abraham, right? And God's promises to Abraham. And we don't let this terrible act define Abraham for the rest of his life. And yet we do that in our context for immigrants, right?
Mm-hmm.
Immigrants, yeah. they cross a border, which is a federal misdemeanor. It's not even a felony crime. And yet we assume that means, you know, that's it. They're horrible people. They're criminals. And that's why I wanted to call that chapter Abraham, the Criminal Immigrant, but my editor would not let me do that. She said, it's going to be hard enough for people to think of Abraham as an immigrant, let alone a criminal one.
Right.
So
that's funny.
So I wanted to put that into context because, of course, the most frequent question I get when I go to speak about immigration is, Karen, what about Romans 13? I want to talk about Romans 13 and how, you know, people are breaking the law and they'll come out. It says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. There's no authority except from God, and that God has placed these authorities in place, right? And so we have to obey them. And I just remind people, one, U.S. laws are not God's immutable laws. Our laws change all the time. How many people are out there trying to get abortion, you know, Roe v. Wade repealed, right? Because they know how our laws work. We live in a constitutional republic and we have a legislative branch and they write laws and amend them all the time. It used to be legal to own people as property,
right.
to deny women the right to vote or own property, right?
Well, and how many of those people sped on the way to church?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, let's point out the level of law we're breaking and how you probably have broken a similar, you know, did you roll through that stop sign, guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I also point out to them, you know, Boaz broke the law when he married Ruth.
Sure.
You know, they were forbidden from marrying Moabites. But I would say that God really blessed that marriage and that union, and that God was not against it, because it seemed that God cared more, right, about the care of Ruth and Naomi, about the people of Judah learning to love their neighbor as themselves, as yeah. God's law commanded, right? To love and welcome the immigrant. And Paul himself was executed by the state because he broke Roman laws that came into conflict with his faith, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, he wrote a lot of letters from prison, right? How many of us know the prison epistles? And we know that Paul. Yeah. And so I feel like people often take this, and I deal with it seriously when they bring it up. I say, okay, let's talk about Romans 13. And really, Abraham was my way of dealing with that in the book, because it's the top question out there when I go speak yeah. about immigration. That, I think, and the other thing that people are, is that they feel like immigrants today are different than their ancestors who came before.
Sure.
Yeah.
And so those are the two big things that people want to know. And I let them know, look, immigrants have not changed. They have the same need, the same humanity. What has changed are the laws. There are no lines to get into, so that creates unlawful immigration, and unlawful immigration leads to vulnerability and invisibility for immigrants, and so that's really the issue. I found out in my research that 98% of the people who came through Ellis Island were admitted to the U.S., 98%.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Basically, if you had lice or, you know, a disease that was evident, like if you had, you know, leprosy or
yeah.
if you had tuberculosis. Right. Yeah, that was a big one. You weren't allowed to enter, but 98%. So basically, if you could get your body on the ship, you were in. And so that has changed dramatically, even though right now we are experiencing the greatest refugee crisis that we know of in recorded history. Mm-hmm. It's greater even than after World War II. I mean, it's terrible. And only 4% of refugees are ever resettled.
We all know it's so easy to fake it when all we care about is being blameless. Oh, Rosalind, outside looking in.
There a couple of questions, but one that just popped into my head. So what, like, I think it's easy for a lot of people who are on the other side, I would say, than probably where we're sitting right now, where, you know, it's illegal. They broke the law, that, you know, deport them. So, but I think the part that we don't really take into consideration is what happens to those people once they're deported. What, mm-hmm. you know, I think a lot of people just have this like misconception that they're just, you know, pitching tents at the border and camped out over there and everything's great. But what happens? Because I've read reports where people have been deported and have been killed in the country they're trying to flee from violence. You know, so what? Mm-hmm. So what? In your experience, what does happen to these people?
So it depends. You know, a lot of times, I'll be honest with you, we lose touch with people once they're deported. We don't know, you know, what happened. We may be able to know for a time. So if you are not Mexican, you are not deported to Mexico. And so that's the other thing that people think, that everybody's deported to Mexico. No, you're deported to your country of origin. Yeah, to your country of origin. So you were deported back to Guatemala, back to Honduras, back to wherever it is, was your origin. And in those countries right now, in Guatemala, in Honduras, and it's funny, I was just talking to a friend who's from El Salvador, and, you know, he's middle class. He's a student at Fuller Seminary, and we were talking, and I said, you know, how do people in El Salvador respond to the migrants? And he said, well, you know, it's really hard because we've had so many Americans and other Westerners seek to help people who have been deported and returned back to El Salvador. And he said, but what happens is, because they're poor, they come back to these poor neighborhoods, which are ravaged by these gangs and controlled by these gangs, or even the police are afraid to enter. I mean, I've read reports when I was looking at asylum cases where the police themselves wear masks when they enforce laws because they're afraid of being recognized, because they might be killed if they're recognized by the... So it's this kind of like terrible lawlessness that's happening where the government doesn't really have control of these areas. And so because people return back to these areas, so he told me the story of a woman who was helped to buy a home and to start a business, only for gangs to come in, like the mafia, they call it the mafia of the poor, and start extorting her and start terrorizing her and her family. And so this is what people return to. There is nothing for them to return to except this, because this is not something that their governments have been able to control. And so one of the most hopeful stories I can tell you was I was recently at the Mexico border from over the border from San Diego into Tijuana. And I did get to meet a lot of Mexican pastors that are working to address the asylum humanitarian crisis at the border. And one of the most heartening things I saw is I visited a shelter that was just for deportees. And so these are people who can't return back unless they come back through the desert like they did before. Mm-hmm. They can't return to the U.S. But this shelter was so dignifying. It was so clean, so organized. They had social workers assisting with job services, with mental health support, with medical support. They even had art therapy.
Oh, wow.
That sounds like better than most shelters in the U.S.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, even it was better than all the detention centers we have on the other side of the border. And even the food they ate was fresh. You know, they all had chores and things to do. And they were just helping people to plan a new future and a new life right there in Mexico. And in fact, if you speak English, you can get jobs at call centers because, you know, a lot of jobs have gone overseas already.
Yeah, sure.
And so it was so heartening to see how much the Mexican church is doing to address this crisis and how much, you know, there was an area we visited of Haitian immigrants who their intent initially was to cross the border into the U.S. But then they found out that the United States ended temporary protected status for them. Mm-hmm. And so then there was no point in crossing over. And so they decided to make their lives there in Mexico. And there's like a little Haiti. And this church just got together and they decided, hey, we have this land. We're going to build homes and it's going to be for these communities. So there's little Haiti and there's little Honduras. And I was really encouraged and heartened. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't awful things happening at the border, because of course there are. But to me, it just spoke of God's greater care. You know, I called my book The God Who Sees, because I feel like these migrants are people the world doesn't value and doesn't see. But God values their lives and God sees them. And this is part of God's provision for them. And that to me was so encouraging, because that's what faith is, right? We trust in what we do not see. Mm-hmm. And we believe that God is at work in things that we don't understand. And so for me, that was such an encouraging time. But yes, the fate of deported people is not what I saw there in Mexico. It's mostly the stories that you hear about where people return and they're murdered or they're extorted, they're forced into gangs, women experience horrible sexual violence. So yeah.
All the things that they were trying to flee from in the first place and that brought them to try to migrate in the very first.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things that you mentioned there that you kind of already started to dispel another misconception, this idea that immigrants come over and they're just a drain on the economy and that sort of thing. But it sounds like these are people who they want to work. They want to make a living. They want to have respect and dignity. And again, I think you rightly said, I think we so often turn them into a statistic or kind of separate them out into what we would call the other. So it's very easy to demonize a group of people when they're just a number now.
Exactly. Yeah, one of the biggest misconceptions is that immigrants come here to receive public benefits. They're not eligible for public benefits.
American that's an important citizens note. Have a very difficult time. Yeah. I'm a social worker. I mean, that's a very difficult thing to access, even as an American citizen born here.
Yes, and you know, one of the things I would point out to people when I would go speak about immigration is I would ask them to go home and take a look at their social security card, and that it's this little piece of construction paper, right?
Right.
Even a teenager with a decent printer could make one, a fake one, mm-hmm. because, and yet that little piece of construction paper is my authorization to work in this country as a U.S. citizen, mm-hmm. right? And if my government cares so much that everybody be a legal worker, why isn't it as secure as my U.S. passport, which has a chip in it? It right. has a chip. Or my driver's license, which has the magnetic strip on the back. Why isn't it that secure? It, to me, it's very duplicitous of our government to have this really conflicting response. You have the IRS and the Social Security Administration who accommodate payments from undocumented immigrants. Mm-hmm. And then you have another part, the DHS, who's maintaining that they shouldn't be present here and is trying to deport them. It's just like we're sending these conflicting messages. It's like having two signs at the border and one says, welcome, you know, mm-hmm. work jobs available. And the other one says, keep out.
Well, and it was kind of how they allowed, you know, they counted slaves or black men and women as 3/5 of a person, yet said, sure, you can fight in our war. Go right, right yeah. ahead, pick up a gun right. and fight for our side. You're a whole person there, but, you know, you're only 3/5 otherwise. It's very conflicted based on what needs are being met by that individual.
It is, and it's treating people as human resources instead of human beings.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah, and last year, undocumented immigrants paid $12 billion in taxes.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're paying a lot, and most of them are doing it with fake Social Security cards. So that means they're not filing for their refund at the end of the year.
Oh, no, because they don't want to do that. No.
Right. So that's even more money that our that the IRS is getting. And so that's a big, big myth around immigration. And so I try to reinforce to people, immigrants come here to work. They pay taxes. In fact, the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian think tank, you know, mm-hmm. even they have acknowledged, and you can go to their page and look at it, that the average undocumented immigrant pays $80,000 more throughout their lifetime into the system than they ever receive back.
Of course, yeah, because they're yeah. not able to get it back.
They're not able to get it back. Now, they are, of course, sending their kids to school. So yeah. so at the state level and the local level, you have that. But I think we'd all agree that an educated population benefits all of us.
Well, and the cost sure. of that is such a drop in the bucket compared to the dollars going
right.
towards, like you said, into the system. So I liked this line a lot from the book where you said, there's plenty for you and there's plenty for me. But do you kind of think that there's a bit of a scarcity mindset in America, and specifically the church, that argues against that statement when it comes to immigration?
Yes. So one of the things that you'll hear people say a lot is that, oh, you know, President Trump and his administration, they dehumanize immigrants. And I believe that that's true. They do that. But I also think that they recognize the humanity of immigrants. They just think American lives are more important than immigrant lives. They yes. would never say that, you know,
yeah.
they would never say that outright. But when you hear them say in the way that they're speaking, that's what I hear.
Yeah, and they talk around it all the time.
Yeah. And so what people experience is, oh, immigrants are going to come in and I'm not going to have a job. Right. Mm-hmm. And I understand that. I understand the person who feels economically imperiled. Right. And yes. they want someone to be responsible for this. And so we have people like Donald Trump who have outright blamed immigrants for this, immigrants, refugees, right, for all of this. And the truth is that immigrants create jobs. Because if you think about it, you know, I live in Baltimore. This is a city that is part of the Rust Belt, right? It's mm-hmm. shrinking. And the only way that cities like mine grow, in fact, Buffalo was brought back from the brink
right.
by refugees and immigrants, because if you think about immigrant communities moving into a city, well, now they need jobs, right? But they also need haircuts. They also will buy groceries. They also need to rent apartments. And so all of these...
And they're going to build housing too.
Right.
As they need it, they're going to be part of the process of making it.
Exactly. So almost all economists say that immigration, and particularly illegal immigration, have benefited the U.S. economy. because immigrants fill in the holes in our labor market at both the high end and the low end of the educational spectrum. And so, yeah, I don't know that many immigrants in Baltimore. I don't know that many American citizens in Baltimore who want to work cleaning linens for all the hospitals that Johns Hopkins has around here.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about hospital linens and the body fluids that are involved in that.
Right.
You know? But this is work that immigrants do here. They work at the Amazon warehouse. They work at the Under Armour warehouse. You know, I know where all the immigrants in my community work. They do a lot of service jobs, a lot of construction jobs. I don't see U.S. citizens flocking to these industries in any way. I see people because they know, oh, I speak English. Maybe I can be a receptionist, you know, if I don't have a lot of education, let's say, right? And so so these are the jobs that immigrants do. And so then it opens up jobs for Americans who have language skills and who have more education to move into other jobs. And what happens is the second generation then, the children of these immigrants, then they're the ones that go to college, right? And they move up. And then the third generation, they're the ones that, you know, major in musical theater and whatever. So that's like the cycle that you see. And it's the cycle that we saw with the Irish immigration, with the Italian immigration, with, you know, Eastern Europeans you had. That's the cycle. You come, you're a poor immigrant, you're struggling to survive, but you provide for your children, right? And they're able to have a better life than you had.
Yeah.
And so
one of the things that I think concerns me and that seems to be a lot of what the politicians are somewhat talking around is that I think some of that us and them is not just that it was a few generations back, but I think that there is some deep-seated racism, just to call it right out, that they're saying, well, that's fine because my people were white and it's the black and brown people that I'm concerned with. And that is just really untenable as part of, I mean, especially coming out of the church specifically, that seems to be a lot of driving this us, them language and these fears and these scarcity mindsets, I think.
Yes. And, you know, when I speak to people, so, you know, I establish some kind of rules of engagement. I don't let people say horrible racist things in front of me, even if I'm speaking to a church. I don't let people do that. And I will rephrase their question. Even if they call people illegals, I said, you know, human beings are not illegal. So we talk about unauthorized immigrants or undocumented immigrants, right? Because they're people. We want to use humanizing, dignifying language.
Of course.
And so when people say outright racist things, I just don't engage. Honestly, those are not the people that I'm after. And I'm not going to defend my humanity to them. Because when I talk about immigrants, I'm talking about me.
Absolutely. Right.
I'm part of that community. And so I want them to... I certainly want people to engage in a respectful dialogue, but when people come at me with really racist things, you know, or recently there was that journalist who said, you know, he didn't want little brown grandchildren someday. You know, I have nothing to say to somebody like that because if you're just an outright racist and you're not there to engage in dialogue, to grow, you're not curious, you're not willing to love your neighbor, then, you know, or to get to know your neighbor to some degree, then there's nothing for us to talk about. They say that whenever you're addressing a group, you know, 20% of people are with you, 20% of people are definitely against you.
Yeah.
And you're going for that 60% in the middle, right? That don't know. They've heard things on both sides. Maybe they don't know what to think or how to think about it.
And that might be an even sharper statistic when you're talking about something as polarizing and as politicized and as just has been so divisive and used divisively. I think that's one of the biggest problems right now is that it's being used to continue to divide and to sow up dissent.
Yes. I think as much as possible, we have to communicate to people like, you are the immigrant. You know, I talk to mostly groups of Christians, and I say, you know, in the New Testament, Paul used this metaphor of us, we're citizens of another world. Our citizenship is not here. You know, our loyalty and our commitment isn't to our own country or nationality, but it's to our God. It's to the things that Jesus said and commanded us to do. And if Jesus was anything, he was not a person that was pro-empire. That's why he was executed by the empire.
You know? That's a very good point.
So I do remind people of that. And I try to get them to see you are the immigrant, according to Paul. That's who you are as someone who is a person of faith, a Christian. And if this is what your Bible says, what your God says, this is why I engage in the book and narrative, because I wanted people to see those stories. I know that we're transformed when we see the Bible from the margins, but most of us don't have eyes to see that, because the people who are in our seminaries and in our pulpits are mostly white men, and they are not seeing the world from the margins. And so I wrote the book to help people to see that perspective of, look, these are immigrants in the Bible. Jesus himself fled. And it was so fascinating to read about the Coptic church in Egypt and how they honor these spaces where they believe the Holy Family took refuge in Egypt. It was really beautiful to learn that, because this is a story that we've lost in the West, right?
Yeah.
We don't focus on Jesus as a refugee. And people have told me, have come up to me and told me they were really surprised by that they had never considered the nationalities of these people and that they had been moving around. I went in the spring. We took my dad to Europe for his 70th birthday, and we went to Dublin. Mm-hmm. And there is an emigration museum there. Emigration, like people who have left Ireland. And so, you know, a lot of people left Ireland and came to the U.S. We know that, right? During the Great Famine.
John's and my people among them. Both of us are Irish descent.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it was so fascinating, the view the Irish had of immigration, because they've had citizens leave. Even in 2015, 30,000 Irish people left. Whoa. Because there's not jobs and economic opportunity.
There's a lot of economic depression.
Right. And what they said, you know, is migration involves loss, but it also involves hope. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's a story of sorrow and grief. And sometimes it's a story of adventure and new opportunities.
Yeah.
And I love the way that they thought about migration, and they talked about how migration has always been a reality in the world. People have always been moving around from place to place in search of different things. And it was just a really beautiful museum. The museum is called EPIC, and at the end you find out that means every person is connected.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's so neat.
Yeah, it was so cool to see that. I was very encouraged, you know, by being there and seeing their very positive view. And one of the things that I appreciated about them is they don't perpetuate a myth about a good immigrant. So we have this myth in our country that immigrants are like hardworking and super grateful and working in service jobs as nannies and lawn care workers, and they serve the greater community and they're just quiet and they go hide back in their homes, right? And are completely law abiding. But they had a section of the museum that was devoted to Irish people who'd gone to other countries and become criminals.
Oh, gosh.
That's amazing.
It was so interesting, because they said, not always do people leave Ireland and go and give their best to another country. Sometimes this happens. And that's the fact. That's a fact. Immigrants are just people. They're imperfect. They mm-hmm. have weaknesses. They have flaws. And we shouldn't have an expectation, you know, that they're somehow better then they should behave better than our citizens. They're just people.
Well, that's a good balanced view of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just doing the best they can, like all of us, right?
Yeah, precisely.
So, yeah. It was really good.
That's amazing. one of the things I realize we're getting close to the end of our time here, but one of the quotes that you have in the book that I thought was so profound, because when I think about Jesus. And by the way, I feel stupid to the point, like the number of times that I've had to point this thing out that should be so obvious when we're talking about Jesus, not only being an immigrant himself, but also he was not a white person with blue eyes. Like, can we?
Absolutely not.
So, like, for people to claim to be Christian and to follow the Bible and to be so anti-immigrant and potentially like have racist tendencies, like, that's just so laughable to me. I'm like, you follow a guy who was an immigrant and who was born in the Middle East. Like, what do you, anyway. So that was not my question. That was just a rant on my behalf. So, but you have this quote in the book that I thought was amazing. Because when I think about Jesus specifically and his teachings and his mission on earth, I think about a guy who was, as you said earlier in the interview, very anti-empire and who came to really like disrupt the system, specifically systems of power that were corrupt and would kind of standing on the neck of the, as you said, the most exposed and the most vulnerable people in society. I mean, it's very, very clear. And so you talk about this movie that you saw, Father Romero. And you have this quote in there that I thought was brilliant, and I just want to quote this really quick and get your thoughts on it. But you quote him where he says the words, I think we should all be reminded of, a church that does not provoke crisis, a gospel that does not disturb, a word of God that does not rankle, a word of God that does not touch the concrete sin of the society in which it is being proclaimed. What kind of gospel is that? Just nice, pious considerations that bother nobody. So again, how do we get back to being the type of Christians who really are on the forefront, who are doing the work, who are helping these people who are clearly in need? Because I read a statistic earlier this week that says something somewhere as high as like 80% of specifically evangelical Christians still support and think that we are doing this magnificent job at the border right now. And it stuns me. So I just don't know. How do we fix that? How do we get back to being the Christians who actually practice what we preach and go out and protect these people and help them? Like, how do we, is there a way to get back there?
I think there is. And I think some of the harm that's been done is, I don't know what your background is specifically, but I became a more serious follower of Jesus in the evangelical church. And I was taught that discipleship was just about me being a slightly better person, not having thoughts about sex, not being selfish, and so, I would read the Bible to get some little nugget for something that I could feel good about that day or something I could learn or whatever. And that was my discipleship model. And I feel like for a long time, I felt like, I don't know if I can be a Christian because this seems very useless to me. This is the only reason that I'm a Christian is so that I have one less dirty thought than I did today. And I think what Romero taught me is that the gospel has real implications for the community, that our discipleship is for the community. It's not just so that we can be a little bit better. That's very self-centered, right? But how can my community be better? How can there be a common good, right? Flourishing for all. Like you see in the book of Ruth, this flourishing for the whole community because they listen to God's teaching about how they should treat immigrants. And so I encourage people that, look, there is no such thing as a marathon in the justice work. And people love to say that. And I'm like, who wants to engage in a marathon? That's 26 miles of running where you're going to soil your own pants. I'm like, I don't want to. But the work of justice, my Twitter friend, Andre Henry says, it's really a relay. You have a part to do and that's all you can do, right? And there are things you can do. And I encourage people, one of the first things they can do is, because it's really common for people to talk to me and want to get involved with immigrants out of a sense of like, pity or compassion, or they've heard some story or saw some picture, right? And I let them know, first of all, you need to really examine, where did you learn about immigration, and what and how does your faith inform that issue? Mm-hmm. Sit with that first and really pray for the community and really reflect on these issues, because it's not enough to just feel compassion. God wants this mutual transformation, right? It's not sure. just me coming along to save this poor immigrant person, but God is doing a work in me as well. And so that's the first thing I encourage people to do. And then I encourage them, one of the best things they can do is call their representatives. And I have this script. I can send you the script if you like. It's so simple, but I have it on like speed dial on my phone.
That's awesome.
And I just, it's very simple. You know, I just say, hi, I want to talk to, you know, do you work in Senator or Representative Elijah Cummings' office? He's my representative here in Baltimore. I want you to know that I'm really upset about what's happening at the border, and I'd like to know what he's doing, how he's voting on these issues. Mm-hmm. And they'll tell me, they take down my name and my, it's something that's very effective. It's more effective than social media. It's more effective than even writing them letters. If you call them,
yeah.
It's very, very effective. And then advocate locally where you are, you know, establish rules of engagement with your friends and family. Don't let them say awful, dehumanizing things to people in your about people in your presence, you know. So I've established that in my circle. You can disagree on the issue of immigration, but you are not allowed to dehumanize immigrants, and you're not allowed to say disparaging and awful things about them. And if it's possible, if there's relationship, sometimes I ask people, you know, just curious questions like, where did you learn that? Where did you hear that? Yeah. Sometimes I offer correction. Like, I meet people all the time who think mm-hmm. that immigration advocates would want open borders. And I say, oh no, I don't know any that are advocating for that. Sure. Most of us want a secure border. So, and also one of the things I tell people is one of the most helpful things you can do is not to post things on social media. Yeah. Until you have checked the facts. And one of the best sites that you can go to is the National Immigration Forum. Another one is the American Immigration Council. These are think tanks. They're mm-hmm. nonpartisan. And all they do is research immigration issues. And it's very accessible. It's not like some high academic language. You just type in whatever you want to know about. Refugees, DACA, anything. And you can learn about it. And you can be informed so that when people say things, I saw somebody post on Facebook about illegal refugees. I'm like, there's no such thing as an illegal refugee. Refugees come here with an immigrant visa, you know?
Right.
So.
Yeah, there's so much misinformation flying around and rhetoric and talking heads about this that don't really know what they're talking about, unfortunately.
Yeah. And that's, and it's really harmful, even when it's something pro-immigrant that's posted. So I tell people, make sure you check, you know, what you're posting. And the last thing, one of the most helpful things people can do is give to organizations that are providing legal services. And there's a lot of them working at the border. I started giving monthly to the shelter that I visited because,
yeah.
you know, it's a branch of the Catholic Church. And they're doing such good work that I want to support them in any way I can.
Sure.
But there's so many groups that are doing really good work. Raices, Texas, Al Otro Lado in California. There's a lot of good groups doing really good work. And frankly, I know a lot of people want to go to the border, want to see things. But what's really needed are people who are legally trained to be able to help these migrants. And you and I can go and we can feel sad, but we really can't help them in the way that a legal representative can.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's another very concrete way to be able to help immigrant families, and especially in the crisis at the border. So I'm sorry, that's such a long answer.
No, that's great.
It's a great answer. It gives some good moments of being able to walk it out and do something, because sometimes it just feels like such a big issue. And one of the main things John and I were talking about even before we started the interview was we just wish we could help, you know, without having to fly to the border and just kind of stand there helpless because we know that's probably mostly what we would do. But we wanted to do things that were actually going to be impactful and helpful to the folks who are really struggling and suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really good. And we can all do something. We can't do everything, but all of us can do something.
I liked your relay metaphor. That's empowering.
Yeah.
Oh man, this is such good information. We'll make sure we put links in the show notes. And if there are any lawyers out there listening and you want to help, where should they go? Like if there are happen to be some lawyers out there who want to help and lend a hand from a legal perspective, who would they get in touch with? You know, that sort of thing.
Well, actually, you can contact World Relief, and we can put you in touch with partner organizations that we work with there. But they have to be specifically immigration lawyers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Very good. Well, immigration lawyers listening, go there and and help out. This has been amazing. Again, this is a topic that we've wanted to cover for a really long time, and your book is terrific. People should go out and get it. Where can people go to stay up on top of what work you're doing and just be informed and that sort of stuff?
Sure. So I have a website. It's karen-gonzalez.com. And then you can also find me on Twitter and Instagram, and it's the same handle. It's @_KarenJGonzalez. And the book is called The God Who Sees, and it's available wherever you like to buy books.
Beautiful.
It's such a well-written book. I really enjoyed reading it and felt like I just learned a ton and saw all of those Bible stories that I was really familiar with as through a really different lens and connected the dots with the things that people who are trying to immigrate these in modern days, you know, what they're really going through and what they're really seeing and how similar it actually is. It's mm-hmm. wild how similar these stories that we're all kind of Sunday school familiar were relating to real people's lives today.
Yeah, it's true. It's amazing. It's the beauty of the Bible that it's so relevant. And we don't need to take it literally, but we need to take it seriously.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very good.
Well, people, you know, obviously listen to this podcast, but there's so much more in the book that we didn't even have a chance to cover. I think Katie and I have like two more pages of notes that we didn't even get to. There's some really amazing stuff in there that was very eye-opening, like I said. So people, go out and get the book, The God Who Sees. And thank you so much for coming on. This is an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. This was great. It was great to talk with you.
All right. Thank you so much.
Suddenly there's tension in my chest. Feels like I'm running when I'm standing still. You're controlling every part of me with six words. The crazy part is that I tell myself it don't hurt. But the truth is...
Well, that was fun.
It sure was.
Katie, this is your second time.
Yeah.
How exciting.
Yeah, I'm feeling like a pretty legit deconstructionist around here.
That's right. We just need. See, people at home though, I don't think can benefit from the fact that I can't see you in your beautiful red hair.
Oh, it's large and in charge.
Like we talked about in the episode, how just truly Irish you are.
I'm super Irish, y'all.
But yeah, that was super fun, and I'm glad you got to be a part of this. Just because, you know, your work as a social worker and stuff like that, I think it relates well. But I thought it was very, very interesting. I thought the book was really good. I wasn't just saying that. Like, it's really, really a well-constructed book.
Mm-hmm.
She's a great writer. And I think you and I were talking about the fact that we just really like the layout in general.
Yeah, she set it up nicely to really tie in Bible characters and stories with the true plight of real people, not only her own story as an immigrant and coming to the U.S. as a child and growing up here and all of the challenges and struggles with that, but also with and her faith journey, which is really very cool. And then also with other people that through her work with World Relief that she's had the opportunity to meet. And what some of their real life discoveries and difficulties for them, and how they really tie so nicely back in to the story of migration and immigration in the Bible. These folks that we've been reading about and learning about in Sunday school for, you know, all of our lives.
Yeah, it's pretty eye-opening. One of the things we didn't get a chance to talk about was the Hebrew translation of the name Hagar, which appears early in the Bible, and you kind of take it for granted, just assume from our very Western, you know, English-speaking society that is her name.
Right.
But in fact, it means foreign thing.
Yeah.
Which is terrible.
Yeah.
Foreign thing.
It's a really tragic way to refer to some person. You know, it's just very dehumanizing, as Karen said.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. She goes into that in the book. Definitely cannot recommend it enough. There's tons of stories, like Katie said, in there that are really, really fascinating. One of the things I wish we had gotten to, we didn't get a chance to get to. There's just so much good information that other questions that I felt were really important that I'm glad we got to. But one of the things I thought was just really telling, specifically because, you know, from a very Western perspective, where, you know, like I said, we won the human lottery. We were born in a very safe place for the most part. You know, obviously we're not without crime, but I can go down the street and get a cheeseburger without fear of, you know, being gunned down in the parking lot. Like, it's not a concern. My daughter
can play
outside.
Or that it was shuttered, that the hamburger stand was shuttered based on the mafia extorting the owner.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And so, like, these are not concerns that we have here, you know, because we're lucky, we're fortunate. Like, we live in this great country that, you know, affords us those freedoms. But, like, some of the disconnect, I think, when we as fortunate people talk about immigration, she tells the story about how when she immigrated over, she's in class, I don't even remember this, but she's talking about how in high school, I think it was, they had like parents who came in who served in the Vietnam War, and they were talking about just the shock of seeing a dead body for the first time. And her reaction was very different. She's like, when I was a kid, I saw a dead body. You know, this was like a regular thing. And one of the things I wanted to get to that we didn't have time is just the difference in terms of like how we view death and violence and things of that nature. It's there's almost a disconnect for us. It's almost like this abstract idea. And what role that plays into how we interact and treat immigrants and how we treat the issue of immigration in general.
Yeah, my husband often says that I could talk about trauma all day, and we didn't even get to bring that up because it is a huge part of what is being inflicted on these individuals who are just trying to keep themselves and their families alive and safe. And the type of bureaucracy and some of the red tape and some of the lengthy waiting and some of the just really broken down parts of our immigration system have truly traumatized these individuals. Not only just even the fact that they could have come here traumatized in the first place with things like having to see a dead body at the age of 7 or something like that. But it's really tragic. I wanted to give you kudos to acknowledging, you didn't use the word, but the word is privilege, John.
Yes, here,
as a white male, you pointed out, and I'm a white female, and we both are really, we acknowledge that and see that for ourselves and try and do our best to work out how that affects us and how that affects the way we see the world.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that you rightly pointed out is that, you know, race certainly plays a large role in how we treat, you know, immigrants who are coming over. And what's interesting is, you know, obviously that's a huge topic of conversation right now.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately has, to some degree or a large degree, even been used as a political tool to divide and secure votes and things of that nature. And it just reminds me of, there was the guest we had on a couple years ago, I think, Dr. Drew Hart, who has a terrific book, that just one of many that we've read that I think was really eye-opening for a person who really does benefit from, you know, a society or that's structured in such a way that, like, I, as a white, middle-class, heterosexual male in the United States of America just benefit from and don't even know it half the time, just because it's so baked into the system. And even starting to become aware of that is just an important step. And the other thing that just came to mind is there's this great book by Jonathan Haidt where he talks about specifically tribalism, and that's something that we really didn't get a ton into, but this idea that, you know, the idea of being part of a tribe, I think the term he uses is it binds and it blinds, meaning that it ties a group of people together over a commonality, which is great and can be great. It's great to be a part of something. It's great to be part of a club.
We all want to belong. That's even part of you know the subtitle of this book.
Yeah, it's funny when you travel, even I was laughing about this. It's funny, you get like kind of excited when you're American too, you know, like you're instantly buddies, you know, in this weird way, like when you're traveling abroad, especially in a country where like you're not proficient with the language, it's almost like this instant connection. Because you're part of this club, you're part of this tribe, you know, you identify as Americans. But it also blinds in the sense, you know, when it's unhealthy, where it creates an us versus them. There's an other now. And I see a lot of that, unfortunately, with this issue of immigration.
It's being deeply exploited.
Yeah. And I think Karen used the term demonize. And that's really what it comes down to, is they're this other group of people where we care less about them, despite the fact that we see these horrific images of kids being torn away from their parents or separated for long periods of time, or children missing in the system or in these cages, these lockups, these parents or these families being split apart. God forbid that ever happened to any one of us. But we seem to care less because of perhaps the color of their skin or, you know, where they come from, what their background is. And it's just, you know, I think that's the thing that we need to bring awareness to.
Very much so.
So anywho, thank you for stepping in.
Yeah, it was fun. I always enjoy being here.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely have you back. Don't worry.
I hope so.
Yeah, we always have a good time. So everybody out there, thank you again for listening. Thanks for hanging in there with us. We know we haven't had a ton of content out this year, but we promise we're still working, although at a very turtle-like pace. we will definitely continue to have more content out. But thank you so much for those who support us on Patreon. Those who follow us on social media and interact with us, it really does make our day when you guys reach out and let us know something that you liked or just want to say hi. You can connect with us on social media through our website, www.thedeconstructionist.com. You can also listen to all of our episodes are loaded up on there. You know, like I said, connect to us on social media. You can visit our web store if you want a sweet t-shirt that I will personally send to you. But yeah, otherwise you can read our blog on there when we remember to update it, and you can see all of our previous guests. So thank you guys so much. Support the music on the show. I don't know who it is right now, but trust me, it'll be in the show notes and you'll hear it throughout the episode. So follow those links, follow them, help support them as an artist, and we appreciate you. And if you haven't already, if you're on Spotify, follow our playlist. We regularly update it with each of the artists that we use on each episode. So you can follow our playlist on there and listen to all the Deconstructionist approved music. So with that being said, I guess that's all we got, Katie.
Absolutely.
We have been your hosts.
I'm Katie Herter.
And I'm John Williamson. Keep deconstructing.
If you're gay and over 85 and you fought for your whole life, when God made you, you just messed up. If you've been raised a Southern Belle, born and bred for show and tell, but you lie down feeling never good enough, I'm so sorry for how it's been. We're broken artists with broken pens. We paint our pride and call it truth. I'm sorry no one explained Jesus to you. If you've heard enough you found on the porch was a pastor that just wanted to be right. And if you really want to pray to him, but you're never sure he's listening, 'cause who could forgive what you did last night? I'm so sorry for what you've heard. We're broken poets with silly words. We paint agendas and call it truth. I'm sorry no one explained Jesus to you. So sorry for all the wrongs. We're broken singers with broken songs. You paint our pride and call it truth. I'm sorry no one explained Jesus to you. I'm sorry no one explained Jesus to you. I'm sorry no one explained Jesus to you.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.